Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's conference call. We have a very informative and up-to-date assessment for you since Steve just got back from Oxford and has been talking with his colleagues at BCA. I hope you will find tonight's call informative, but I assure you, it won't be quite as entertaining as last night's presidential debate. As you might know, Steve teaches at UCLA and for the past 21 years has taught two popular investing classes, security analysis as well as advanced security analysis. We thought it might be a good idea to bring the classroom into your living room by having three of Steve's top students interview him today. Wen, Nat, and Cassidy are interns with Steve and work with him on competitive strategy, equity analysis, and looking at stocks.
Professor, how was your trip to Oxford? And can you share any insights with us about your trip and what you learned?
But there could be an impact in the future. So I don't want to rule a downturn. You know, too many things could happen during the exit period, which is about 2 years. The one thing I did notice is that some of the international companies like Virgin, Atlantic, it looks like those kind of situations have deteriorated because when the price of the ticket stayed the same after the pound went in decline, you would think that they reduced the price of their ticket to attract more flyers, but that wasn't the case.
You taught us about a black swan event. Could you explain what that is and how that formed your opinion about Brexit?
Sure, Cassie. That's a really good question. A black swan event is an event that no one really expects. And how you kind of compensate that is when you're managing an asset like a stock or a bond, you try to think about what the improbable event might happen, not what the probable event. So, you know, everybody was thinking, oh, yes, for sure, Britain and the UK are going to stay within the EU. But a black swan would say, you know what, there's a possibility that they would not stay in the EU. And that's what we did was we thought about different scenarios in case of different events happening, and we had a plan of action. You know, a lot of the people, the commentators, were going to say that they left, and there probably was a good possibility that they wouldn't leave. But we took the opposite view, which is a black swan, that they would leave. And speaking of a black swan event, I was just speaking with my colleagues at BCA up in Montreal, and it's a very good chance that Donald Trump could win the election, and that would be another example of a black swan event where a low probability event becomes reality. So you might want to take a contrarian bet, Cassidy.
Professor, didn't you short the UK pound in YYR?
Yeah, you know, I did short the pound the YYR because I thought, you know, there's a good chance that this black swan event will occur, and why not try to make some money out of it? So we took a somewhat risky position where we shorted the pound, but we used options to limit our downside risk. I'm always looking at limiting my downside risk. So if I lost, I would lose the option premium, but I wouldn't lose a lot of principal. I would lose a little principal, but not that much. So the pound went from 147 to 129. We made a good amount of money. I have a funny story for you, though, Wen. I was driving up to San Francisco, and I called back Robert, our trader, and I said, where's our position in relation to the pound? He says, well, it looks like they're going to vote to stay, and your position is really underwater. And by the time I got to Nob Hill for dinner, I saw the news on the TV in the restaurant, and things had completely changed. And by that morning, a losing position turned into a winning position, and my fortune was reversed.
Wow. I recall you mentioned that many of your clients were calling you before the Brexit vote, encouraging you to sell the stocks in their portfolio. What did you do?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I first started as a money manager, I studied finance, and I probably should have studied psychology because I'm not sure at times I'm either an investment manager or a psychologist. So my instincts told me to do absolutely nothing. This wasn't like it was going to be in 2008 where there was going to be a financial crisis. So after the Brexit vote, the market went down for a few days, but that was about it. How we manage risk, and we pay a lot of attention to that, is through asset allocation. In other words, stocks versus bonds. And I had decided to reduce the risk in the portfolio much earlier in January for other reasons than Brexit by reducing stocks.
Professor, we are still learning about economics. I hear you talk about liquidity conditions. Could you please further educate us on this concept?
Oh, now, to do justice to that subject of economics, it would take a whole quarter. You'd have to spend the next 3 years with me before you got your degree. So I'll try to be extremely brief for our audience. Think of it this way. When interest rates go down, liquidity goes up. When interest rates go up, liquidity goes down. Where do you think we are now? Well, we are now in a position where liquidity is drying up because interest rates are going up, even though the Federal Reserve has not officially raised them. The dollar has artificially raised interest rates. So we can also have what we call a liquidity trap, where no one wants to borrow, but the banks want to lend. And that's where we are now.
We know.
Okay, Nat. Yeah, where we are now, that's a good question. The U.S. dollar is rising, and it's an effective way to raise interest rates with actually having to do it. So with the rising dollar, some liquidity has evaporated. Now we're talking about a real raise in interest rates by the Federal Reserve Board unless they chicken out or some catastrophe happens. Even if they raise interest rates in December, that won't increase very much because it won't affect the stock market. In order for the stock market to be affected, the interest rate has to be raised above what we call the natural rate of interest or the neutral rate or the equilibrium rate. And I won't get into the technicalities here, but we can talk about it in class, but it won't do that in December. It could happen in 2017.
Professor, you always talk about earnings. What do you think the earnings coming in now tells us?
Well, you know, despite the easy liquidity from the central bank, earnings are unlikely to meet expectations. I mean, let's face it. For the last several years, the market's been flat, hasn't gone anywhere in the last, oh, I'd say, 20 months. And why is that? Because the liquidity that the central bank is pushing out is not working anymore. We have to have rising earnings in order to push the stock market further. The stock market is a collective group of all the information available to every investor in the world. That would be equivalent to saying every investor in the world is stupid, which we know is not the case. So I think stocks could be vulnerable, especially in this overvalued, expensive stock market.
Professor, you also always talk about finding beauty in an investment ugly contest. What do you mean by that? I find it quite strange.
Well, you know, everybody remembers John Maynard Keynes as the brilliant economist and mathematician, but very few knew him as one of the world's greatest speculators of all times. He had made large fortunes and then lost them again. Maybe that's because he went to the other school, Cambridge University, not Oxford. But he equated a beauty contest to stock picking. He essentially asked the question to a group of men, which woman would win the beauty contest? Each man responded, well, of course, the most beautiful woman in the room. But Keynes responded, no, the woman who is perceived to be the most beautiful. So in stocks, that means that the Facebooks, Amazons, and Teslas of the world are the beauty contest winners.
So why don't you buy those stocks?
Oh, Wen, you should know better. You've taken my classes, and you've heard me lecture about it. But I suppose the audience would like to hear why. 1990s and 2000s, my colleagues and clients were pushing me towards the stocks of the heyday. Cisco, Enron, Siebel, dot-coms, et cetera. I remember being at a party of a client friend, and I got actually cornered in the wall where they said I was a dinosaur and I picked old-fashioned stocks. and that Buffett's success track record was going to evaporate because I was just like Buffett. But you know what? Going into year 2000, my reputation was enhanced because all those stocks in the dot-com era got smashed. And things aren't really different. First of all, it's hard to distinguish between a fad stock and the real McCoy. And I'm going to give you some real-world examples here. For example, when in the early 1980s, there were PC makers like Apple, IBM, Vector Graphics, Osborne, Radio Shack, Commodore, and Compaq. The only one left is Apple. You see, I've been lecturing class too long, and I lost my voice. So there's no surefire method in which to select the perfect company. Let's take Tesla. Everybody loves Tesla. So there's no, you know, they make a great product, and they were first to market with a $125,000 electric car for rich man. I'd rather pocket the money and buy a Toyota Corolla. But GM, Ford, and Toyota are quickly catching up and will make an electric car for the masses at a lower cost than Tesla. Elon Musk is a genius. There's no doubt about it, and he's a financial wizard. Both Tesla and Solar City are essentially broke, and he has to merge those two to save Solar City. Solar City may drag Tesla down into the debt rat hole. Tesla only makes money by selling carbon credits to the polluters, not their cars, and they have no economies of scale. And as the stock is priced for perfection to boot, let's take a look at Amazon. They consistently do not make money quarter after quarter, and they're empire builders, as far as I can tell. No thanks. You mean a company like Oil-Dry, which makes self-absorbent cleaning materials, diapers, and other industrial goods, or a company that has consistent earnings, like debt or little debt, like Cisco, Elbit, or CyberArk. You know, just going back to Keynes, I think the structure of low rates, some investors are going to be very unhappy, especially those who buy and hold broad index funds. If you think about it, the S&P 500 peaked the index fund in 1999, and it took till 2012 to get back even. So as such, investors need to be like what Captain Kirk from Star Trek once said, go boldly where no man has gone before. Just like we did in year 2000 when we shunned the dot-com stocks and bought some of the old line industrials, and we had consistent performance, maybe not year after year, but during that term period of 1999 through 2012, we had consistent performance. So index investing can be great at certain periods of time and not so great at others. So you need to capture a wider net and buy stocks that they think will win the next Keynes beauty contest.
Professor, speaking of beauty, don't you like Shiseido and the L'Oreal?
Yes, well, you know, we own L'Oreal, and as you know, we're considering Shiseido. We are also thinking about Inditex, Zara. You did the research report on that one. We like companies that grow. We don't want to have companies that are dead in the water, but we're not going to buy companies that that are fad stocks or where we have to pay too much money for them. And if any of you have been in a Zara store, Zara by far is the most successful retail operation, and they've been one of the few who've been able to navigate their retail operations on an online operation as well. And, of course, beauty products are immune to recessions. So what we're going to do and what we have been doing is we've been buying beauty companies like L'Oreal and some of the others to provide a defensive portfolio in case the economy turns south.
What else do you like?
Well, we love the home builders, which are doing well, and we like our cybersecurity stocks. People sometimes have a misnomer that I don't like tech stocks, but if you look at your portfolio, we have Elbit, we have CyberArk, we have some other high-tech stocks, and we like those as well.
You have spoken about a bubble before. Are we in one now?
Let's face it. Stocks are where they are today because of easy money. If the Federal Reserve had a normal interest rate policy, the market would likely be lower. Just as easy money fueled the 2000 tech boom and crash, the 2000 real estate boom and crash, this easy money is fueling another bubble.
Should we sell all our stocks?
Nat, you know market timing is impossible. What if I sold all our stocks in early March after the market was down approximately 10% over 2 months? Where would we be today? Besides, the bubble is not happening in stocks, although the market is clearly not cheap. The bubble is in bonds, especially high-yield and foreign bonds. However, I'm not too worried about our bond portfolio because we have them laddered and we usually hold them to maturity.
Now I understand. That is why you have an asset allocation portfolio. What is the type of asset allocation right now for a balanced account?
Well, the typical balanced account is 50 to 55% bonds, although the percentage may vary from account to account. 30 to 35% bonds. I'm sorry, it was 50 to 55% stocks. 30 to 35% bonds in the balance in cash.
What risk to the portfolio do you see in the near future?
Well, the biggest threat is a large rise in interest rates in 2017. That could spoil the party. I'm watching this really carefully, as my colleagues at BCA Research are too, and I will adjust my thinking as events unfold.
Any last thoughts?
The ENT guy about my loss of voice. But I'll try to finish up here. I keep going back to what Benjamin Graham used to write about. Here's some key points. Focus on your holding your stocks for the long term, and don't turn what could be an advantage into a disadvantage by short-term trading. I don't chase bad stocks, and neither did Graham, because they're here today and gone tomorrow. Don't have an all-stock portfolio nor an all-bond portfolio. Keep it diversified. Approach selection if you would like you were a businessman buying a whole business, even though you're buying a fraction of one. That's another reason why I don't like index funds, because they have a bunch of junk in them, sometimes in sectors that I don't want. For example, in year 2000, the S&P 500 was loaded with tech stocks, and if you bought the Spider Index Fund, that's what you would have got. But I didn't want that because I knew they were a bomb waiting to happen. So I like individual stock picking, and that way I can avoid the deep trouble when it happens. Graham also said, what would a prudent man do? So I manage my money, I manage your money just like the way I manage my money. Because just like you and me, I'm sure you don't want to say this famous phrase, would you like fries with that order? So good returns are not measured by the risk you take, but how much effort you put in the process. And that is really one of the best things Graham ever said, and Buffett reaffirms it. And that is, to do well in the market isn't how much risk you take, like Amazon or Facebook or some of those. It's how much effort you put in the research. That's why I got three interns right now, and I had five during the summer. We are very research intensive. It reminds me of the contest I had in my class. Three students that were older, in their 50s, were in my class, and they bet me that they could beat the market over a long period of time. So I said to them, okay, bring in 6 months of statements, and I'll have my TA analyze them, and if you beat the market, I would take you to Maestro Steakhouse on Cannon Drive in Beverly Hills. If you didn't beat the market, you have to take me and three of my friends. I wasn't married at the time. So we did analyze it, and, of course, these braggadocio people didn't beat the market. And guess what? I took three of the friends that I knew would abuse the privilege just to make my point, and we had a fabulous time at Maestro's. So I want to thank you for your confidence in us. We're going to do a good job for you like we always have, and now we're going to open up the audience for questions.
The conference has been unmuted.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. Feel free to ask your questions now.
May I ask you? This is Carl Rosenzweig, and I would like to know what effect do you think
the winner of this presidential election will have on the market for the next few months and years?
That's a good question, Saul. What my colleagues at BCA in the bookies in London tell me is that the race is pretty even. I don't know about last night, but until last night, the race was pretty easy. BCA basically says if Hillary wins, the market should stay flat and go up slightly because a lot of her policies probably won't be enacted. If Trump wins, the market will go down at first, but then once his policies come out and he tells the citizens what he's going to do, the market will go flat to maybe slightly up.
Thank you.
I have a question. What will Brexit do to my university that was just voted number one in the world, Oxford? Anybody know? No.
No.
I guess not. Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it, and I'm sure I'll be speaking much different for us. So I'll be speaking with you in the future.
Thank you, Steve, and rest your voice. It was very good.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Okay. Good night. That's Moshe. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.